Somewhere Between an Atom and a Star, 1946-53. The start of November had old Cressy staring at a small ornamental tree, a Prunus cerulata, a Japanese cherry. No one knew who had planted it because the area was dominated by plane trees, but some bright spark had once had a bright idea and had given it a home there as an act of joyous rebellion. Or maybe a bird had long ago shat out the seed that had grown into such startling wonderment. But whoever, whatever, was the cause, the tree had become for Cressy a symbol of everything good. What amazed him most about the tree was that it had survived the Blitz and also a V-2 bomb blast that had taken out the Imperial gasworks, which had taken out the windows of the streets around, scattering coal for the taking. Amidst the wail of sirens and great wall of flames, Cressy had placed his hand on the trunk, reassuring it that the worst was over, for there was little else of interest to bomb in the area. Even the church had gone. It was after this last act of destruction that Cressy took it upon himself to nurture the tree. Its origins, he'd read, had been the forests of Central Asia, and Cress thought that a mighty journey to have undertaken. Cress was deep like that. So he watered it and talked to it whenever he passed. It didn't matter that the fruit it bore was unpalatable, because cherries upset his stomach, always had something to do with a mild irritation in his lower bowel. He was on firmer ground with apples. Every April, as thick clusters of white and pink blossom hung heavy and low and became the talk of the street, Cressy walked methodically, zen-like, with a glass of stout from Coles, and sat under the blossoming tree, knowingly enacting the Japanese ritual of Hanami, something he'd read about in the library. People passed by and laughed, but Cress closed his eyes and listened to the song of the breeze through the flower heads. He was oblivious to everything except that moment. Cherry blossom and a glass of stout. Hard to beat. Old Cress had never been young Cress. He'd been born Alfred Cresswell and soon became Egg on account of his premature balding pate. Egg and Cress came next after that culinary marriage, but it was the Cress that stuck. He could fix anything, find anything, and was everyone's go-to man in need. Cress couldn't read till he was 30. Lot of shame in that empty space. Peg hated winter. She hated the smells of damp wool and coal smoke. She hated nights that began at 3 and days that barely raised their heads from the pillow. She hated the same old that winter brought. She hated the bomb sites and the lack and the mirrors that never lied. She hated magazines that showed American life with wide plains and fancy cars and a Hollywood sign that made you dream of something more. She hated the sun-bronzed women in big sunglasses outside big houses with white fences and advertisements for cigarettes with scowling cowboys and red-mouthed beauties. She hated that Eddie Clayton had disappeared 2 years before. She hated the wind that whistled through her teeth, and she hated that summer was too far away and that Christmas stood between her and another year. Coming down the stairs, she snagged her stocking and sat down on the last step. Peggy never cried because she was dry, but it didn't mean she didn't feel. Sometimes she felt like dying, but who wants to hear that? Clack, clack, clack along the street, Peggy's tune. All right, Peg, said old Cress, standing beneath his tree. Peg nodded and walked on. It's never as bad. It's bloody bad today, Cress, so keep it to yourself. Col stood in the doorway of the pub and smoked. God, the loneliness in his soul. It manifested as acid reflux, and it was the winter that brought the long burn to his esophagus, along with the dark, misty days and a misty yearning for the woman who used to be his wife, Agnes Agnew. A step up for Cole with her Huguenot genes and name. Who was he then, and who was he now? That was as far as he got along the byways and stiles of his existential musing. He knew something had gone wrong, but for the life of him, he didn't know how to put it right. Agnes was still out there somewhere, on a rock, farming sheep or maybe goats. People would have felt more sorry for him had she died, and he would have liked to have had that, a bit more sorry. Thank God he had Ginny to keep him on the straight. Ah, Ginny. She had the look of Agnes about her these days. Cressy called her engrossing, and she was engrossing, till she opened her mouth and a kid tumbled out. Ginny was always racing from his sight. The acid begins to roil as he thinks about her absences. There'd been some shenanigans during the Blitz when he'd caught her snogging a sailor. Sailor didn't understand when Cole kept hitting him and saying, "She's only 10, you fuck." Sailor spent his shore leave in the hospital. Cole unwrapped a peppermint. A sharp slug of wind rumbled through his small intestine like an underground train. This was the London Ulysses walked back into. Winter 1946, 2 months before the big snows came, a city grey and struggling like an old fella outside the mission, all grace and has-been. Ulysses rode the bus east and jumped off at Kingsland Road, walked behind the flurry of traffic to the bomb site where his dad's workshop had once been. Cressy had warned him of the blast, got a letter to him in North Africa, and had written it like a telegram. "Ulysses, stop. Your dad's workshop hit. Stop. Saved a globe and a copper plate. Stop. No one killed. Stop. Hope Africa's interesting. Stop. Chris." It was true his old man hadn't died in the bombings. He'd died a couple of years before, diagnosed with a rare blood cancer. "At least it's not my lungs," he'd said as they'd walked out of the London hospital together. 2 weeks later, he was called back in. "It's your lungs," he'd said. His dad Wilbur believed he was going to beat the cancer, as he called it, with the same misguided surety that had lost him thousands of pounds and a few trusted friends over a lifetime. "I feel lucky, son," was what he said, a precursor to disaster if ever there was one. It was September, and they walked over to Tubby Folgate's together to make a final bet, one that said his dad would be alive till the new year. Tubby laughed and said he'd have given him better odds on a white Christmas. That night, they sat out in the small bricked yard. Neither knew what to say to the other. Mrs. Ashley's soprano voice rose from the neighbouring lav, and she played her part and added an exquisite sweetness to this scene of father and son on the precipice of farewell. So tender. Wilbur got out his notebook and quietly said, "I've done my calculations, son, and the numbers add up." And his frail finger moved across the page, tracing the illegible mystery of chance. "See," he said. And then his arm shot up to a midnight sky, revealing the shocking translucency of his skin. "Look," he said. And there, a sudden clearing in the fog, as if heaven's chenille had been pulled back just for him. Same frail finger moving across the celestial architecture, across the constellations and the containment and hopes of all they were. And from gambler to philosopher, he said, "I've lived under the fickle movement of planetary adventure. I've encountered long dark nights when the sirens sound, but the moment stars align and the shift of sweet wind greets you of a morning, this is when mystery becomes knowing and fortune becomes love." Nora popped her head out the front door. "What's he going on about, love?" "Dunno, mum. I think it's the morphine." "And the arc of flight settles a small bird 1,000 miles from home, with heat on its wings and a calm delight at the mastery of navigation." Wilbur withered within the month. His lungs rattled like an overworked boiler, and he became teeth and bone and essence. "Everything on the black," was the last thing he said. He died in the middle of the night on the downstairs sofa. Ulysses kept vigil in the armchair next to him, and when he looked over, his dad was glowing on top of the bed. Glare from a street lamp had snuck in through the curtain and lit up the old boy like some medieval saint. The wake was at Cole's. Stout and whiskey and tea. Peg buttered the sandwiches and forgot to put the filling in, and Ginny cried because she was always a kid and always would be. It was a good send-off. Tubby Folgate sent a wreath, paid for by his dad's last bet, and a card that said, "You were 1 in 1,000,000 to 1.
"End of an era," said Cressy to Ulysses. "Up to you now, boy."
Ulysses was 17. Big words for slight shoulders. Ulysses turned the corner, and Cole's pub came into sight. The Stoat and Parrot was a tatty Georgian tavern that had never seen better days. Ragged bunting left over from VE Day hung down from the guttering, and there was enough pigeon shit on the bricks to give Nelson's column a run for its money. For years it was known as the Stoat, till the eponymous bird flew down the chimney and refused to leave, thus instigating a hasty and careless addition to the pub's name. The sign swung to and fro in the breeze, a weary creak of indolence.
Come in or fuck off. Come in or fuck off.
Ulysses pushed open the door, and the fire to his right gave off a ripe old smell, all sour and smarting bodies. The old ones were huddled around the hearth exactly as he'd left them, same faces, less teeth, and above the fire on a narrow shelf, the stuffed stoat, looking exactly as it did the day it died, angry and incredulous. Over by the bar, the large blue-fronted Amazonian parrot guarded the till with a glum weariness. Ulysses dropped his kit bag by the footrest and rubbed the parrot's chest.
Hello, Claudie, he said. Remember me, fella?
But Claude stared at him mute, eyes glazed by post-traumatic stress. Suddenly, Claude ducked low and hid his head repeatedly against a bell. Cole came through from the snug.
Well, look who's here. Good to see you, Tempy. We thought you'd forgotten us.
They shook hands. Peg here? Asked Ulysses as he took off his hat and smoothed his hair in the mirror behind the bar.
Nah, she don't work here anymore, son.
Peg don't?
Nah,
not for a while. She's gone up in the world, typist. 60 words a minute and that's just her gob. You been to Kathleen's?
Why should I go to Kathleen's?
No reason.
People were looking at him now. Cole pulled him a pint.
There you go, mate, he said.
Cheers, Cole. And Ulysses drank. He looked at the parrot and said, I'm surprised he's still alive, Cole.
So am I, boy. So am I. Larger the bird, longer the life. That's what they say. And that parrot's a fat fuck. I reckon he's 60 to the day. He'll bury me.
Don't he talk no more?
Not after the gasworks went up. Lost his feathers and his voice, just like that. Stress from the explosion. Ugly thing he was. Like a pheasant ready for the oven. Jenny pulled him back from the brint. Even Anne's that girl. I wanted him dead, of course. I always felt he had something to do with Agnes leaving.
Really?
He took sides, Temps, and I can't forget something like that.
Cole released a shot of whiskey from the optics and raised his glass.
To you, mate, he said. Glad to have you back.
Thanks, Cole.
You know what's strange?
Go on.
Last thing that bird said before the great molt. The quality of mercy is not strained. Strained.
Strange word for a parrot to use, don't you think? Where do you think you got that from?
Shakespeare.
You reckon?
I know.
They drank in silence, staring at the bird. Ulysses looked about.
Got rid of the sawdust, then?
Yeah, it was time. Brought in the wrong crowd.
Wallpaper the same.
Yep. But you know what they say. If it ain't broke.
But it was all broke, thought Ulysses. The whole fucking place was broke. The wallpaper curled at the seams and the lights flickered as if a storm was approaching, an effect enhanced by the leaded green windows in the upper bays, bringing a watery glow to the afternoon radiance. And, of course, a parrot that didn't speak.
Actually, said Cole, one change. I've diversified. I sell aspirin and stamps now. One-stop shop.
Masterful, Cole. That's what I thought. You got plans?
Another pint after this, please.
Coming up, lad, said Cole over his specs.
You look in one piece. You intact?
Ulysses nodded.
There's always a job here for you, you know that.
And he pushed the pint towards him.
On the ass, he said.
Ulysses lifted the glass.
Oh, Jesus, said Cole. This is doing me head in. You need to go to Kathleen's. I'm sorry, boy, but...
Ulysses put down the pint and wiped his mouth.
Nobody touches that, he said.
Nobody will, mate, said Cole.
And Ulysses turned and thumped through the door. He walked down the road, turned left into the square of Gothic villas, then a right, stood in front of a proud house in a row of struggle.
Kathleen,
he shouted and knocked.
Kathleen!
A sturdy redhead of middle years opened the door and said,
Well, look who's here.
Cole said, I have to see you.
She laughed.
Of course he did.
Where's Peg?
Not here.
What's that mean?
You want to come in, Sunshine? I want to know what's what.
6 years is what's what. She won't wait in Tempe.
I never expected her to. We still got that place on the Crescent.
Have you, El? Masons needed that after they were bombed out. Everyone's on a list.
Jesus, he said quietly. A small child emerged from Kath's side. You a granny now?
Not yet, smart ass.
What's her name? He said.
Don't you know?
Yeah, I'm a mind reader too. Tell Peg I'm back. And he began to walk away. Tell her.
The kid's Peg's, Temps.
He stopped. Kath nodded to the kid.
The kid. She's Peg's.
I heard.
Can't you see the likeness? Yankee dad.
Peg all right? Kathleen shrugged.
Kid's called Alice, she said.
Right. 5 minutes later, the doors of the pub opened and Ulysses reappeared.
Been to Kathleen's?
I've been.
Good lad.
So you'll need a job and somewhere to live then. Cole pushed his beer across the bar. No one touched this, right?
No one at all, said Cole.
Ulysses drank. He wiped his mouth and adjusted his hat in the mirror.
Nice hat, said Cole.
Ulysses took it off and showed him.
It's Italian, see?
Anyone round here wears this hat, you know they've nicked it. Simple as.
It is my hat.
No one touches it.
Like no one touches your drink, said Cole.
That's right.
You should put your name in it, he said.
I might. Any time you want to talk, son, said Cole, and he threw in the keys and disappeared into the snug. Ulysses walked down to the canal. The immediate familiar whiff of the place, the icy, smoggy chug to the air, the gasometers proud and monumental. He sat on a bench, the slow drift of a barge and then silence. He watched the world hardly move at all. So there's a kid, he thought. Before he could think further, he looked up to see old Cressy rushing down the stairs calling out his name. Ulysses stood up. Cressy's head smelt of coal dust and cough syrup.
You're all here, boy,
said Cress, holding his face.
Mostly, said Ulysses.
Thank God,
said Cress, punching him lightly on both arms, a playful 1-2, 1-2, because the old fellow was choked. They sat down and Cressy raised the bag in his hand and said,
Here it is, the only one to survive.
And he carefully lifted out a globe the size of a football.
He said, It was quite a night, Temps. I heard that all the globes shot into the air where the bomb landed, hovered in the warm-up draft and spun. A mini-universe lit by flames. Now wouldn't that have been something to see? She's in Nicaragua, by the way.
Who is?
Your mother. I looked for her. Took me over a month, but I found her. In Nicaragua. Next to Managua.
Peg's got a kid, Chris.
None of it was mine to tell, boy.
I know, Chris, I know. Ulysses took out his cigarettes. You know the bloke?
An American fella. 1 minute here, then gone.
You see him, said Ulysses, lighting up.
No one did. Kept him away from me, she did. That was decent.
Cressy took a cigarette.
There were feelings, son. He was no fly by night.
Ulysses nodded. Peg in a bad way.
She'd bite her own tongue off before saying so.
And Cress blew out a stream of smoke and picked a strand of tobacco off his tongue. Should I go and find her?
Do leave her be. She's got a crap end of cards and has been bluffing all this time. You turning up means she's been forced to show. But it'll be done on her terms, always is. You've forgotten how she works.
They watched a lone swan swim by till it disappeared under the bridge.
Here,
said Cress, and he nudged Ulysses.
Something for you to think about, something I read.
Go on.
The scale of man, spatially, is about midway between the atom and the star.
Ulysses looked at him and frowned. Atom and a star, he said. Cress nodded.
Spatially,
he said. That's a lot to take in.
Isn't it? I haven't had a good night's sleep since.
Well, you wouldn't, would you?
Although a stronger candidate for the midway position would probably be a hippopotamus.
What do you think it means? Cress thought for a moment.
Interconnectedness, I think.
And they both nodded that time. They turned their attention to the canal just as the swan reappeared. Cress said,
You're back. I reckon I'll sleep tonight.
You seen who's back? They said to Peg when she returned from the typing pool. Mrs. Lundy, the baker, had told the butcher, who had told the Cranes, who owned the cafe. Gloria Gosford, who sold haberdashery, was having tea in the cafe and overheard the butcher tell the Cranes. She went straight to Mr. Bellingham, who sold furniture. And, of course, Mr. Bellingham told me, said Linda, who was having a very public affair with the man. They walked with Peg along the street, yakking. Yeah, yeah, it's getting boring now, said Peg to each and every one of them. She was glad to put a key in the lock and close the door. Later, over gin, Kath said Ulysses had looked reasonable. He'd always been fucking reasonable, said Peg. And Kath said he looked a bit more handsome, and she said that wouldn't have been hard, and Kath said naughty, and she hated she was such a bitch, because what had he ever done to her? Only married her in case he died. You get money, Peg, that's what he said, always looking out for her. She went upstairs to her room and kicked off her heels. 20 minutes at the typewriter board, flexing her fingers. She was getting good. Good at shorthand, too. She'd earn her own money in America when Eddie came to get her. He ain't coming now, Kath had said. What the fuck did she know? He'd bought her the Pittman's course. Said she could have anything she wanted, and he thought she was going to say a fur coat or something shiny. But she said a typing course, and she noticed he looked at her differently that day, like she had dreams too, like she was worth something. He'll come because he loves me, she said, and Cass said, I never said he didn't love you. You saw it, right? Said Peg. I saw it, said Cass. The kid stared next to her, the kid who looked like him. Same shiny, thick, dark hair and bright eyes. Some nights the similarity could have ripped her guts out. She'd never wanted a kid, and her mum had never wanted her. Bloody, careless, stupid cows. And now Tempe's back. Over at the mirror, she looked a mess. A mother would have loved to have seen her like that.
Now you know how I feel, she would have said. Thought you had it all worked out, didn't you? Think you're better than me, don't you?
This is what you men do to us women, thought Peg. You make us hate us for your absence, for your lies, for your violence. She got up and went to the window. I'm still here, Eddie, and I know you're out there. For a whole week, the pub was on tenterhooks, waiting for Peggy the gunslinger to enter town and shoot up the piece. Ulysses opened up and the regulars barreled in with coats smelling of mothballs and complaining about the wait. Then they'd stop and look about. She been in yet? Nah, not yet, said Cole. What's she up to, that girl? What's she ever been up to, said Cole. The tension simmered. The pub had never been so quiet. Mr. Mason had a heart attack in the wait and he was in death's grip before he hit the floor, but at least something had happened. They all knew Peg would turn up sooner or later, but it was how she was going to do it. That was the question. 4 evenings later, she didn't disappoint. With an hour and 10 minutes of drinking left and Piano Pete warmed up, she pushed open the doors and stood backlit by a particularly bright streetlight. It was all MGM and the Lion Roared. She dropped her cigarette and stubbed it out under her shoe. Aye up, said Cole, and Ulysses raised his head from the bar. Easy, lad, whispered Cole. Easy there. The swing of her hips, the sound of her heels across the floor, droll Pete tapping C-flat in time with her stride until she headed his way and the C-flat fell flat. She glanced through the sheet music, but she knew what she was going to sing. This one, she said quietly, and handed Pete his instruction. Slow, she whispered, real slow. And Pete obliged. Fingers dexterous along the keys, ash falling from his moist lips, smoke irritating his bloodshot eyes. Ulysses watched her every move. He'd had women in Italy, but none like her. Had even loved some of them, but not like her. In Naples, he used to watch the women head over to the American camp. The Yanks had lots of money, lots of charm. The women were sad and beautiful. What a combination, he thought. He never stood a chance. He felt Cole's hand on his back. Cole knew he didn't stand a chance. Peg, you only had to look at her to know she was born to better things. She knew it, and he saw it. She was an upriver swimmer, struggling against a contemptible tide, but by God she tried. She sang to no one, locked eyes with no one, focused on an empty corner of the room that held a ghost that had haunted her till the end of her days. Drinks were left untouched and cheeks were glazed by tears. She mesmerized because that was the Peggy spell. She had class. She may have stolen it, but she had it. And she told you so when she sang, because she sang for her life and for yours too. Because the world never turned out the way you wanted it to. It simply turned, and you hung on. The last notes rang out. Her voice cracked. Piano Pete wept. A standing ovation and whistling and cheering, and boy did she look modest, a look she'd practiced well. Old Cressy sent over a gin, and she raised the glass to him, and he raised his to hers, and she downed it in one. And she turned towards the bar, the sound of 30 heads following. Crack, crack, crack went the necks. Hips swaying, arms swinging, and by God, those cards were on the table now. Cressy said she'd got a crap hand, but everyone could see she was the one holding the aces. Keep that all steady, said Cole before he disappeared into the snug. Ulysses and Peg locked eyes, and it was familiar, and there was history, and also truce. She walked up to the counter. You could have heard a pin drop. Hey, soldier, she said, and touched his cheek. Hey, you, he said, and touched her hand. I, they said in unison. You first, she said. Nah, you, he said. Okay, she said. I want a divorce, Tempy. Blimey, he said. The sound of 30 mouths exhaling. The sound of Claude manically pecking his bell. The next morning, Peg woke in his bed, because that's what they did. She groaned loudly and gripped him tight with her thighs before he got soft. She rolled off and said, I'm glad you're not dead. It was as romantic as she ever got. She climbed out from the sheets, and he sat up and watched her. Her arse in the early morning light, moon and sun as one. Her arm across her stomach, hiding the marks that had appeared since he left. Tell me something no one's ever told me before, she said. You're perfect, he said. She laughed and got back into her clothes and he watched. He said, I could help with the kid. Not your responsibility, Temps. Her in front of the mirror now, tidying her hair. But we can still look after one another. Look out for one. You're too good. Her putting on her lipstick. He smiled. No, Temps. You're too good. It's not a compliment. And with one hand on the doorknob and ready to go, she turned and said, I'll see you around. Same time tomorrow. We won't be doing that again. We'll see, he said, and he blew her a kiss. He listened to a stomp down the stairs, the sound of the front door opening and shutting, Ginny calling after her. He got up and turned the electric heater on. He wrapped a sheet around himself and stood at the window and watched her cross the road. He wondered what he'd come back for if it wasn't her. Ginny running out now, without her coat, and Peg rubbing Ginny's arms, her sweet concern. Cressy coming round the corner, dragging a large pine tree behind him. A rusty pub sign swinging in December's throaty wheeze, and a traumatized parrot too far from home. This was his world now. Somewhere between an atom and a star was this. Come February 1947, the snow fell. Great drifts of the stuff clogged up the city and the canal froze over. Ulysses spent his days clearing paths and keeping the fires going as best he could. Coal was hard to come by and windows grew ice. The streets were silent and the nights banked by white.
The Eskimos have 50 words for snow, said Cressy, looking out of the kitchen window. And I've got one for idiot, said Cole, and I'm looking at it. I thought you were making stew. I've got 9 rabbits in the coal box, hopping about, waiting for a pot for tomorrow's lunch. Ulysses smelt the milk and poured it into his cup of tea. And what are you laughing about? Said Cole. Nothing, said Ulysses. You're like one of them monkeys.
A macaque, said Cressy.
A what?
A macaque. He's like a macaque.
Stop saying the fucking word macaque. Jesus, thousands need a job and I end up with you two.
Get out the wrong side of the bed, did you, Cole?
No, actually, temper. Au contraire.
New lady friend,
whispered Cress. Ulysses grimaced.
This is the first day of the rest of my life, said Cole.
And what will tomorrow be, Cole? Will it be the first day again or the second day? Said Ulysses. Colthorpe burped. Fair point, he said. Jesus, Cole, you stink.
Liver sausage, he said, holding up his sandwich. Got it cheap.
Drive the dogs wild, do you?
You seen Ginny? Asked Cole.
Not upstairs, said Ulysses.
Wouldn't have asked, would I? Said Cole,
and his hand gripped his stomach as a surge of acid banked. Ulysses said, I'll go, and he downed his tea, grabbed his coat and boots, and headed out. He went to Mrs. Lundy's first, and she said Ginny had been in and brought a loaf of bread, as she always did. He detoured to Cress's tree, but she wasn't there either. He headed on down to the canal, even though she wasn't supposed to go there by herself. It was quiet down there, a couple of barges puffing out smoke and ducks resting on the ice. He blew on his hands and stuffed them in his pockets.
Ginny,
he called out. He walked the towpath, followed fresh footprints in a recent dump of snow. The slow movement of a barge carrying coal passed by and broke the ice. Pound for pound, it was now more expensive than gold, according to Cole, anyhow.
Ginny!
There she was, up ahead, on a bench.
Ginny,
said Ulysses. He sat down next to her and put his arm around her.
Cold, ain't it? He said.
You warm enough?
Bread's warm, Uli,
she said in a funny nasal voice, hugging the loaf to her chest. What are you doing down here?
Feeding ducks.
The end of the loaf had been torn away. You're kind, he said, and kissed her head. You talk to anyone down here?
I'm not allowed to talk to strangers.
Good girl, he said, and lit a cigarette. He blew out smoke and realized she was copying him.
I like it down here,
she said. Me too. She pressed her finger against the scar on his lip.
Hurt?
Not much.
Lying?
He held her finger and grinned. You know everything, don't you?
Peg teached me.
Worst teachers, he thought, and flicked his cigarette away. Ginny said,
you love Peg.
Of course I do.
You her boyfriend?
It's complicated, Ginny.
Because you went away?
Not just that.
You look sad, she said.
Yeah.
Feet cold, Yuli.
I bet they are. Come on, up we go, Gingin. Let's go get you warm.
Carry my bread.
Of course, he said. Hey, Ginny turned. Thanks for the chat.
Any time, Yuli. I'm always ears.
He laughed and pulled her close. It was a week before the big melt. A regular's night with the same old faces shuffling in for prime position around the fire. They were getting bold and brought sandwiches with them, and Mrs. Lovell snuck in a roast dinner under foil. They absorbed the heat like lizards and left everyone else shivering under coats. Cole couldn't wait for them to die. In the snug, a couple of coppers were lording it, keeping the language clean. Cole was on the long pull, generous measures to encourage a lock-in, a ploy to shift the stack of liver sausage sandwiches stinking up the counter. Piano Pete was warming up with a bit of Beethoven. He'd spent all afternoon playing for a beginner's tap class full of two left feet. Those classes were the septic boil of his wasted life. Pete could have gone to the Royal Academy, everyone knew that. He moved seamlessly on to Wagner, a sure sign that his evening was turning bitter.
Jig it up, Pete, said Cole, recognising the shift in mood.
And Pete swung into swing, and the pub went from dry to thirst. The upbeat shift in musical choice affected everyone, but most notably Claude. He launched himself into an aeronautical display of rare aptitude, and his final demonstration of complex asymmetric hovering brought raucous applause from the usually less-than-impressed drinking clientele.
That bird's showing off, said old Cress. That bird's in love.
Talking out of your ass, said Cole. But Cressy knew his birds, and Claude ended up in front of the mirror, rubbing himself vigorously against a bottle of rum.
Disgusting, said Cole. What's he doing? Said Ginny. Bringing relief to his swollen cloaca, said Cress.
That's a word you don't hear often, said Ulysses.
You have to, said Cole.
By 11, the lock-in had become official, and the coppers had buggered off with a couple of quid in their pockets. It was a man against the elements kind of night, and Ulysses went down to the cellar to fetch a box of candles. Piano Pete was sitting in the corner, making a considerable dent in a bottle of whiskey.
All right, Pete.
Not bad, Temps. You?
Not bad. You want me to say I don't know where you are?
If you don't mind, Temps. Suddenly he lost me confidence.
Ulysses smiled. He liked Pete, always had. Pete was as elusive as they came. Might have been rich or might have been poor. Might have been brought up in a castle or under a bridge. Pete had been a conscientious objector and had done a bit of time. Pete was bruised, but Pete was kind. Here you go, Pete, said Ulysses, and he covered him with a regulation army blanket. He placed a lit candle next to him.
I'll be up in a minute, said Pete.
Stay where you are, said Ulysses.
Bless you, said Pete.
Upstairs, Ulysses set candles on saucers, one on each table. He turned off the lights, and the old ones complained about the power cut, but Ulysses ignored them. He placed a record that Cress had given him on the turntable. Cress had said, I reckon this might be a bit of all right, you know, something special, and he was right. The woman sang in Italian, and her voice took him back to a painting in another country and another version of himself. Cole came out of the snug into the bar, ridiculing the woman's voice. He was full of impersonations that evening, and he pitched his voice high and tremulous. It's what Cole did when he didn't understand something. He made it ridiculous and brought it down to an acceptable level, crotch height usually, so he could piss on it. Peg was a bit like that, and he should have seen it coming, but he'd become daft and a bit moony on account of the music and the candlelight and the soft fall of snow against the windows. Peg had been drinking up a storm, and there was an edge to her, something cruel in her eyes. On nights like these, beauty made her uncomfortable, as if there was only room for hers. She waved him over, and when he sat down, she immediately started talking about Eddie. Told him what she planned to do when Eddie came to get her. I was everything to that man, and he was everything to me. She was in full-on goad mode. Ulysses drank his beer and ignored her. And then she nudged him and said, you ever meet anyone? He thought about the question, the two roads that led away from it, the yes or no that would attract pity or scorn. He said he did, actually. And he talked easily about Evelyn. And there's Peggy laughing at him now, nudging him, all older woman, this and that. And he said it's not like that. It was about who she was and what she said and what she knew. And Ulysses knew he shouldn't have done it, but he did it anyway, because the music offered a skylight to another dawn. He said stuff about art and paintings. And Italy, things that Evelyn had told him, things he'd often thought about in the conflicting sounds of night. That's when Peg struck. She said, Tommy Bruskin didn't come back, McDogs didn't come back, John Baines lost a leg, Gary Castle's gone fucking doolally, and you talk about art. What kind of war did you have? You have a nice one, did you, Tempe? Fucking nice one. Everyone looking at them now. Everyone thinking, this is more like it. Fireworks instead of sonatas. Ulysses put down his glass slowly. He looked up and said, I dodged bullets for 6 years, Peg. Yours are a piece of piss. Stomp, stomp, stomp. She broke the glass in the door. You'll have to pay for that, mate, said Cole, laughing. I'll pay, said Ulysses, and the music played on. The next morning, Ulysses was shoveling snow whilst Cole and Cress surveyed the repair he'd made on the door. Suddenly, from inside, a tall shadow approached through the stained glass. What the fuck? Said Cole, and he grabbed the hammer and raised it. It was Pete coming through the door, doing his best impression of Lazarus.
I feel like I've lost everything, Temps. Days, weeks.
You're frightening me, Pete, said Cole. Look at me. Pete looked at him, eyes and mouth crusted with drool.
You'll be all right after a good night's sleep, said Ulysses.
And remember, said Cole, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Pete couldn't quite get his head around that and began to cry. That's just the whiskey working its way out, said Cole. You'll feel better in an hour. Keep it flowing, mate. Come on, Pete, said Cress. I'll help you back home. Lean on me, son. Cole watched them depart. Blind leading the blind, he said. Aye, aye, he said, as he blew out a thick plume of smoke. Here she comes. Fuck off, Cole, said Peg, approaching. Fucking off now, said Cole, heading back in the warmth. Peg was sheepish and shivering, a bit cold and a lot hungover. She said to Ulysses, You're all right. He knew that was her apology. He said, Not bad. You?
Ah, you know.
Hunched shoulders, hands in pockets, big furrow between her eyebrows. He carried on shoveling, and she surprised him by mouthing the S word. What's that? He said. You heard, she said. No, I didn't. Go on. Again.
Sorry, she whispered.
And again.
Sorry.
She laughed and punched him, and he ditched the spade and grabbed hold of her. Peggy said, I bloody missed you, and you start giving me grief. I know, she said. I got back when loads didn't. I know, she said. And stuff helped me, he said. And I learnt things, and I met people, and I'm proud of what I got to know. I know, she said. And he started to dance with her, and she laughed more, and he'd forgotten that it was the best thing in the world to make her laugh. They stopped their dance and caught their breath. Peg looked warmer. She had colour in her cheeks. You still want a divorce? He said. Do you mind? Nah. So they did it. They got divorced and got more friendly. Even shared the kid called Alice. Peg kept the name Temper because there was no way she'd go back to Potts. And the weeks and months rolled out ahead of them and Ordinary returned. The snow disappeared and the sun shone again and everyone complained how hot it was, how winter was really better. The kid called Alice grew and Cole's new lady friend was called Denise. Peg got a job in a typing pool for an insurance firm off Tottenham Court Road and Ulysses settled into civvy life. By the summer of 1948, London was ready for the Olympics. Cole was happy that neither Japan nor Germany had been invited to take part, and Denise agreed, saying that England would probably have a better chance in the shooting now. Cole wanted to increase custom during the fortnight, and it was Cressy who suggested the television. He said he knew someone who had access to the back of a lorry, and before long, a small set was moved into the snug, covered to look like a birdcage. Inside was the sweet sound of a 9-inch pie. Wembley Stadium had never looked so small. A week before the opening ceremony, Cress walked into the pub, all woozy and vacant-eyed, and Cole said, You look a bit touched, mate.
I am touched, said Cress.
Here, sit down, said Ulysses, and he pulled out a chair and handed him a small glass of beer.
So what's up? Said Cole. I had a vision.
Jesus, said Cole.
Not him. Fanny Blankers Curran.
Oh? Dutch athlete, said Ulysses, feeding Claude a Brazil nut.
She was doing the housework, said Cress.
And she appeared to you, Alfred Cresswell, out of all the people in the world.
She looked at me and said four.
Four?
Actually, she said fear. That's Dutch for four. Fear or four. And then she showed me a wedding ring. So I went down to Tubby's and put a bet on.
For her to be married four times, said Cole, laughing.
For her to win four gold medals.
What'd you put on her? Said Ulysses.
Everything.
Jeez, Cress.
Not much then, said Cole, disappearing into the snug.
It's a sure one, Tempy. Your dad was all around me. I could feel him. I could smell him.
Pocket full of loose change.
That's the stuff. You put on what you could afford, son. This one's set to go. Trust me. Is everything on the black all over again?
So Ulysses did. Went on his break down to Tubby's and put on what he had in his wallet and all he'd saved in his tin. And in the days that followed, the crowds in the snug increased as word got around about Cress's bet. People stopped him in the street and wished him luck. None of it was about luck, though. He knew that. This was destiny. On the 2nd of August, at 4:45 p.m. and 12 seconds, Fanny crossed the line to win the 100 metres gold medal. Ginny and the kid jumped up and down and Pete screamed and thought he'd coughed up a tonsil. Is that possible, Temps? I don't think so, Pete. On the blackboard, Ulysses wrote, one down, three to go. Cole said, you're dreaming, mate. Never going to happen. Over my dead body. Don't tempt me, said Peg. On the 4th of August at 4 p.m. and 11.2 seconds, Fanny crossed the line in first place to win the 80 metres hurdles. The crowds were smaller than the previous race due to the earlier start, and Cole said, yeah, but who's really interested in women's hurdles?
I am, said Denise,
hoisting up her skirt and coming a cropper over a bar stool. Ulysses picked up the chalk. Two down, two to go, appeared on the blackboard.